represent him, is going to be extremely transformed by how the digitization is employed. And finally, pools of content. You know, one of the things that is interesting about the EMRCA project, it's not a model train project. I mean, you'll see that in a minute. It is about two huge deep pools of content. Architecture, building, people live in buildings, people work in buildings, and they're more and more paying attention to architecture. And railroads is the first network that tied the country together. I mean, the whole concept of what the internet does for us right now was essentially its precursor was the rail network in the United States in the late 19th, early 20th century. And then there's the juxtaposition of aesthetics. I mean, I always really like this picture of the Williams College Museum of Art. Because here you had this Greek Revival rotunda, which is the first college library. It was actually a panopticon, which was Jeremy Bentham's designs for prisons, actually. They built, but they also used it for libraries. And I bought a Robert Morris sculpture for the Williams College Museum of Art, which you see in the rotunda. I won't go into that, but I think this is one of the most spectacular works that Robert Morris ever did. And then if you look through that into what was a reading room, originally added in 1896 to the college library, to see the Assyrian reliefs, which were brought back to Williams College by a couple of intrepid graduate alumni explorers in the 1860s or the 1870s, and you see all of this kind of like framed in a picture. What does that say about kind of like how culture can be used and how culture can be combined? And then there's the program. I mean, some of the 300 exhibitions that Olivier referred to that I did at the Guggenheim, of course, I'm famous for two of them, Giorgio Armani and Motorcycles. But that aside, these were both impeccably researched and impeccably curated and incredibly well-installed installations. I may have pointed out once that we spent I don't know how much time and effort designing the mannequins so that the only the dresses or only the costumes would show. So you don't see any hands, feet, legs, heads, or arms. And it shows, it highlights the it highlights the work of art, and as we know, how fashion has become, you know, and costume art have become, you know, much more popular concepts than they were in the museum field 50 years ago. So the Armani exhibition was, I think, for us, amazing. And we carpeted the whole Guggenheim, by the way. That's a great carpet that we laid down. And we got Bob Wilson to design the installation with these scrims. So it took the balconies and the parapets of the Guggenheim and actually made them into these corridors where you could look at the works of, I think there were maybe 300 or 400 works of Giorgio Armani. And it was, I think, a huge testament and impeccably well-organized and curated and very popular, by the way, that people wanted to come and see that. Of course, the other famous one here, the motorcycle, where Frank Gehry designed the interior of the Guggenheim as an engine of a motorcycle. But you have to look at these objects to see that these objects are about the transportation and social history of the world. You know, the first motorcycle dates from the 1860s. The last one, well, we had when we opened the exhibition in 1999. But Gehry's installation, the luscious objects themselves, and the audience it generated. I mean, these were audience generators. And so what we saw by tweaking the institution, not sacrificing the aesthetics, expanding the concepts to address a broader and wider audience, the Guggenheim attendance grew from about 300,000 to over a million, where is the capacity of the building right now. And then when you add in Bilbao and Las Vegas and some of the other things, we actually pushed the global Guggenheim clinics over 3 million people a year. That built the brand, that brought more people, that brought more attention. And it brought more benefit. I showed this slide as part of the, I think was the second talk, third talk, Bilbao, how there was a before and after slide where their initial investment was tiny compared to the gigantic benefit. And in the first 20 years, 22 million people went to a city as as tourists that none had ever gone to before, and there were practically no hotels that could sustain that activity. So we knew that that benefit, social benefit, could be generated. And I also began to start to think about the art. This is a Robert Rauschenberg. I think it's the greatest Robert Rauschenberg. I bought this in 1996, I think, directly from the artist. It's a 1962 painting called Barge. It cost $6 million at the time. I also bought this, and I think, by the way, now, this is probably, if this were to come up at auction, I would venture to say it would go up close to $100 million. And that's just the sort of the nature of the art market right now. But this is content, by the way. This is content. And I remember buying this kind of Twombly, also in 1996, for $29 million. One painting, $29 million. That was over 20 years ago. And again, I don't imagine what this would go for now, but the point is that art museums can't really compete from a historical, particularly new art museums, can't compete for art on this level. You know, $29 million, let's say that it's worth $55 million. The content that we're talking about for EMRCA is going to cost certainly around between 15 and $20 million. And it's going to be endlessly more fascinating and endlessly more engaging. So this theory, or thinking about museums theoretically, this is all critical to the EMRCA project. And like most things, EMRCA began in China. That's not just a slightly ironic statement. Literally, the EMRCA project began in China. Because between 2011 and 2014, after I left at Guggenheim, I did a number of major projects in China, more than these four. But these are the four that contributed most directly to the EMRCA concept. The first was that we were hired in 2011 by the Beijing Workers' Labor Union to develop a museum for the former Imperial Ancestral Shrine, which is just outside the gates of the Forbidden City. In this picture, it's in the red box. Now, essentially, the story of this was that when Mao Zedong came to power in January of 1951, 3 months later, in April, he gave the Imperial Ancestral Shrine to the Beijing Workers' Labor Union to use as a cultural park, because officially, when communists took over, religion and ancestor worship were no longer the primary features of Chinese society. And essentially, until 2008, that Imperial Ancestral Shrine languished. I think they charged a penny to go into it. It slightly became decrepit, and there was a certain amount of activity, I guess. The shrine had a board. The board rented out properties. And if you look carefully in this photograph here, you can see that right here and right here, it was like a rat warren of small industrial buildings. And on the other side, this is actually a 5,000-seat sports stadium. These are tennis courts. So in keeping with the cultural purposes, the Beijing Workers' Labor Union used that for that purpose. So we were hired to work with a Chinese architect named Zhu Pei. And the first thing, part of the study, was to restore the territory of the shrine back to its original. So this is what the original of the ancestral shrine looked like. And you see this astonishing feature here that these two courtyards were actually empty. You know, and I think I've forgotten what rationale was. I knew it at one time. Something having to do with protection. But our proposal then was to build temporary museum buildings in the empty courtyards, buildings that could be removed at a one-year notice if other purposes were found. So essentially, they had to be non-invasive. But this design was done, our team did this with the Chinese architect Zhu Pei, and this design was supremely elegant. And this was a hugely influential project. We also did another project with Zhu Pei, which became the Minchong China Bank 751 Museum. And I remember the first time I walked into the building, this is what it looked like. It was kind of messed over redux. 2010. So we did the interior designs. I'm not going to show you a lot about this, but this project was realized. This project opened in 2013. And this is also the same architect as Juppé. And here we are with my son Nick on the right, and Juppé is to, well, he's on the right, but Juppé is to my right, and some Kiefer during the construction of that project. So that was project number two, first two by Juppé. Third one, I showed you already a picture of it, was the Nation Lake Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art. We started working in 2011 for the metropolitan city of Changsha. The building was almost finished, but when I first went to the site, this is what the site looked like when they were just starting to work. And there was this little stream, which you see in the background. The stream became a lake. This was the GCAM team that we had assembled to work on the project. There were a number of curators and assistants. There's Peter Nova, there's people from Hong Kong and Vienna and Milan who were all part of our, who worked for the company, GCAM. And you can see that the stream became a lake. This was the concept for the building. The groundbreaking took place in 2012. At that time, I was even a famous guy in town. A picture was on the billboards. This was the groundbreaking. The Chinese don't do anything in small steps or small scale. This was, Zaha didn't go because of the difficult terrain. This was her design partner, Patrick Schumacher. And this is my team shoveling dirt for the beginning of the construction of the museum. We worked for 4 years with Zaha Hadid on this project. And one of the galleries, because they had no collection, zero collection, and they were not going to be spending $29 million or $6 million on contemporary art or any amount of contemporary art. So part of our problem is, how do you take a 300,000 square foot building and make a cultural program? First thing I started to look at was the architecture. Could we do architecture museum? So the idea of the architecture museum actually began as part of this analysis. Of course, the building then began, the building was almost finished. And this is actually from last May, from the rotunda of the building. I'm gonna come back to this, but that was project three. Project four was the Hunan Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art. This was also in the town, the city of Changsha. This is important because the architect that we selected for this was Richard Gluckman, and we want Richard Gluckman to do the project here in North Adams. So, this is the next part of this, the boys in the Eureka moment. How did I find myself back in North Adams in 2013? Well, these are my two sons on the red. And Daniel was four at the time. And his mother was going to go to London for 2 years to the Courtauld. So I didn't want to have Daniel go to school in New York City. I said, oh my God, it's going to be a pain in the neck. We're going to have to have babysitters and nannies. And just to travel the city was difficult. And I always kept my house here in Williamstown, and Pine Cobble was nearby. So it was because of Daniel, actually, that I came back to Williamstown in 2013, spent most of my time here. And of course, the golf course was a good feature. Both Nick and Daniel like golf. And then, this slide is out of sequence. Sorry, it's supposed to be someplace else. It's supposed to be up near the beginning. The other event, so a series of serendipitous events took place in 2013. One, the plan to come back to Williamstown, and still thinking about some of these ideas, but I never considered anything like Louis Mercier. The other one was a seminar, I guess you call it a seminar, or a dialogue that I did with the creative director of Disney Imagineering, UCLA, in May of 2013. And this was their topic. This was set by the UCLA Architecture Department. Extreme culture, the intermix of real and virtual realities. The guy from Disney Imagineering was Scott Trowbridge, and they were planning a theme park. And his message, basically, was theme parks are becoming more like art museums. And my message was the reverse of that. Art museums are becoming more like theme parks. But along the way, the dialogue was elevated. Well, at the same time, This is the bingo moment. I went to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art because I wanted to see this work by Chris Burden, which I heard was an architectural fantasy. And I didn't know that it was populated by 1,000 slot cars. And when I first went to see it with Michael Govan, it wasn't operating. The reason that it wasn't operating, by the way, look at all the people in here. The reason it wasn't operating is that slot cars, as many of you know, have rubber wheels. You run 5 days a week, 6 days a week, you gotta replace the wheels. And 1,000 slot cars, that wasn't something they wanted to do. So when I went to see it, it wasn't running. There were even 4 or 5 people in the gallery. I came back the next day, Michael had the curator come. While we were there, he turned it on. I'd say in 15 minutes, 200 people were in the gallery. And nobody was leaving. So that was it. It was motion. How could you viscerally activate the museum, take the architectural concept, and populate it with motion? As I said again, look at all the people that you see in the background. And this is a fantasy architectural environment. And imagine if you got to do this on a completely different scale. The next piece that was tied into this was model railroads. Like many parents, I bought my son Lionel trains when he was 4, and they just sat in the basement for 20 years. And so I took a look at model trains in 2014, and I found that there was this company up in northern Michigan that made these impeccably detailed scale model replicas of the history of American railroads, not for toys, but for collectors. These things would cost somewhere between $7,000 and $10,000 a piece. They were done in additions of 100. And they're basically historically accurate down to the last rivet. They're manufactured in Korea. But all of a sudden, this whole technology side of this, and these were O-scale trains. So the bingo moment got magnified by the discovery that the model train industry had moved around. And if I could combine architecture and movement and the history of American railroads, we had the bingo moment concept. We also had to deal with the issue of how to do the modeling, because this is not like having a bunch of bells in the basement where you're kind of putting these together. We're talking about something on a slightly pharaonic scale. Well, it turned out that what was catching up was the movie industry, because the scanning of buildings with laser digital scanners could produce a file from which you could digitally print the Grand Central Station, for example, down to the level of detail of the sculpture. So we discovered 3D printing, a digital laser cutting, and digital CNC milling that would allow us to produce, a mass produce, basically, on a large scale. A lot of organization goes into this. The detailing on buildings actually that would end up looking like this, because this is actually a model train model. At one of the press the prototypes for our activity, this is a place called Miniature Wonderland in Hamburg, Germany, which gets a little over 1 million visitors a year, and on a different scale. This is much smaller, but this level of realism set standards. So the concept continues to develop. What begins to emerge is an alternative model for art museums. An art museum theme park experience that appeals directly to all the ages from 4 to 104. So EMRCA is a narrative history of international post-industrial architecture. It's also a narrative history of immersive precision, immersive precision scale history of American railroads. And all of the components are on precision scale 1 to 48. That means everything about this has to be, the aesthetics of this have to be impeccable. This is not kind of like a little of this, a little of that. This is an historically accurate, detailed analysis of potentially 1,200 buildings, of which 164 are masterpiece buildings. So we decided to build a mock-up of this, of one of the buildings. This is in the theater in North Adams. So on a scale of 1 to 48, this is not the tallest building in the design, the Empire State Building would be 37 feet high. Now, attendance precedents. Zaha was working on a Glasgow Museum of Transportation. There was Miniature Wonderland, and the two boys and I went out to a road trip to Northern California to see the California State Railway Museum. And what I discovered was that the Glasgow Museum, I had never been to Glasgow, but it had 1.3 million visitors to a transportation museum. Miniature Wonderland got over 1.2 million visitors in Hamburg. Whoever goes to Hamburg is a tourist. I mean, I've been to Hamburg a lot. And then there was the California State Railroad Museum. There were 600,000 visitors. So we thought we were on to something. And a little bit further research, we discovered that almost a quarter of all Americans go to a history site, a historical site, or a history-themed museum each year. So the project now is coming together. This was going to be ultra-low cost and ultra-high impact. Could that be conceptually designed? Well, the first step for me, as I referred to the meeting at the with the mayor and the airport commission, we were looking to build a global contemporary art museum and storage facility, by the way, because there's another business in here, which is art storage, a burgeoning business now. And I could do a whole lecture on why and the art market, but we're not going to fit that in. So. We commissioned Richard Gluckman to do the design for the airport. This is right next to Stop and Shop, across from the tourist, on 5 acres that would be by the airport. And now, after the bingo moment, the serendipitous exchanges of my involvement in China, I finally landed back in the fall of 2014 in North Adams. And I start to talk to Joe, and Joe tells me about he's trying to buy Heritage Park, which is that place that's adjacent a little bit south of Massmoka, and make it part of Massmoka, but his board was being a little bit reluctant. I won't go into that story, but by the summer of 2015, I had a serendipitous exchange with the former governor, Michael Dukakis, who was up in the Berkshire on his annual trip. What I didn't know that Michael Dukakis, when he retired from state government, he became vice chairman of Amtrak. Michael Dukakis is a train guy. So I started talking about model train, the architecture train museum. Mike Dukakis says, let's go talk to Bill Weld. So we talked to Bill Weld in September of 2015, and Bill Weld said, let's do a press conference. Just announce it, we're gonna do it. So on the 5th of December 2015, we did a press conference here in North Adams. It was the mayor, Richard Gluckman, the architect, the two governors. In April of 2015, we did then a feasibility study in the first 3 months of 2016. And then in April, we gathered our first round of investors. That included Dr. Brown, and Jim Hunter, and Ron Fulkerson, and Tony Murad, and Greg Elrod. And we assembled a staff. We started to work on this project seriously. Our first plans were to take Building 4 and make it bigger and longer. After the press conference, the press picked it up, the New York Times, our forum. There was the one time we did encourage a story, as long as we got the cover story, it was in the summer of 2017, I think, through the Berkshire Eagle. Back to design development. In January of 2017, I was circling around this notion of audience maximization. What would it take? And I thought, well, first of all, it's going to take scale. This is going to have to be big. But it doesn't mean it's expensive. I mean, scale is an inspiring experience if it's done the right way. Bilbao is successful because of its scale. Same design, half the size, 1/10 of the impact. I mean, I can tell you that equation would hold up. So scale was important, the content was important, the architecture was important. So I called Frank, I said, Frank, I've designed the building. Here it is. I did a PowerPoint something or other and flipped out an image of one of Frank's buildings and squashed it and stuck it on top of the UMRCA project. And I said, Frank, you're going to be the designer of this. We quickly came to the conclusion that the piece of land at Heritage Park wasn't big enough, and we needed another piece, something that was a little bit bigger. It was actually Jeff Grunshaw who suggested this. Go across the river under the overpass to that site between the river and the railroad. It was really just an entrance to the Atkins recycling facility. So we then made a deal with Mayor Altenbrecht and the North Adams Redevelopment Authority and purchased the options on 16 acres, which included everything that you see, Heritage Park and to the west of Route 8. And then we went after downtown because the project was expanding. I invited Jean Nouvel to come to Massachusetts, or to Williamstown, late 2016. And by the way, I just saw some fancy magazine, Financial Times magazine section, did a profile of Jean Nouvel. They asked him what was his favorite place to visit. He said, Williamstown, Massachusetts. So, Jean was absolutely impressed with Mass MoCA. We fast forwarded to 2017. We invited Frank to Heritage Park. We see the president of MCLA, Greg Elrath, Steve Shepard, Frank Gehry, Jeff Thompson, the mayor and master of ceremonies with Governor Wells, and we locked Frank into the project. But before that, I took him to the theater. He said, no, I want to do the theater. We do the theater. So anyway, we kind of like left it. We had to resolve that. And I think the reason he wanted to do the theater is he was offended by my design. Because I was basically saying, I want a garage, a warehouse, an inexpensive warehouse, and you can decorate the top. But anyway, the point is that there was a certain amount, Frank was in the game, and there was a certain amount of attention to what we were doing. Then we had to come up with an image for the building. So we started working with our team at EMRCA to James Justin Yecki, who's sitting right here, who's our chief architect. And we started to put together this concept, which I more or less allowed to be influenced by Mies van der Rohe and a coal shuttle for railroads for hauling coal back and forth, essentially by exposing the ribs and making this entirely out of precast concrete and steel. So we built into our model this concept for the museum. We also spent a great deal of time on the internal design and dynamics of the architecture museum. What kinds of buildings, everything from Frank Gehry to, there's not a Frank Gehry building in the background, to the Brooklyn Bridge, to Frank Lloyd Wright, to Mies van der Rohe, to the two main stations in New York City, including the one that was destroyed. We were going to recreate Penn Station. Altogether, we ended up with, I have to look hard to believe this, we ended up with 1,200, no, it's one, two, three, it's around 1,200 buildings in total by 74 architects. We're going to be the masterpiece buildings. Also, we focused on the installation side of it. EMRCA will feature 107 simultaneously operating diesel and electric-powered locomotives in O-scale. 12 separate lines, 9.5 miles naturally tracked of two-rail track, with five major railroads, rail yards and ground passes. So we saw EMRCA as a continuous motion, and we were designing landscape to do this. In wondrous landscapes, verdant valleys, high plateaus, blistering true speed scale on two high-speed rail lines, 2 to 12 high-speed rail lines. Insulation over the highest bridges, the longest tunnels, authentic scenography, and a control panel that's 110 feet by 35 feet, which is slightly larger than the control room for Penn Station. And we see this as something where, if you look at the control panel, you can see all the television screens on the bottom. There's this massive, about the size of this auditorium, maybe bigger actually, that will allow you to track any one of your five favorite trends on your telephone or devices that we provide. As for the background, rather than try to paint it or photograph it, we decided to project it to make a 1,200 foot by 36 foot, 30 foot continuous video that would allow us to control the time of day, the weather, the clouds, airplanes, leaves, birds, whatever we would do in the background of what we were doing, and extend the actual installation. This was the design of the 354, is it? Yeah, digital projectors that would be required to operate in sync from the rear. The entire thing would be electrified. The whole installation would be electrified. It would have extraordinary symphonic sound. This is our sound technology. And we would actually manufacture the landscapes by looking at original places. We set up a research facility in Williamstown, about 3,000 square feet, where I've hired a team of people to learn how to do this, and they become, I think, world experts in model making. These are actual models on the research facility that we built from scratch, literally going to the hardware store, and keeping track of what the components are, how much time it takes, how much we use it, so we can estimate the kind of workforce that we need when we implement this thing. We built a 1 to 24 inch model at our offices in North Adams. We kept on working on what we could do to engage the audience and the area. Obviously, there would be student and intern learning workshops and all the technologies that we were using to develop and maintain this. It would be a kinetic, interactive, immersive, content-rich, high-tech, cinematic, educational experience. We would use virtual reality, holographic, augmented reality enhancements, and that would allow us to do things like that. We're still working on the way. So, we're close to the end now. So, the City of North Adams Cultural Development Master Plan. As I said, we started with Heritage Park. We did a full study with, it was funded by the state government on the restoration and development of Heritage Park. We expanded to downtown. We built our models at our office. A few more details on the hotel, which you might find interesting. This would be a John Nouvel designed hotel of 110 rooms. The rooms might look something like this. It would have a rooftop bar, so you can imagine in the summer or in this cold, warm winter days, a rooftop bar is 1,500 square feet. It would also have a spa and a wellness center. And thanks to one of our investors, Steve Musk, he invested another amount to hire a professional hospitality consultant to analyze the hotel project fairly recently. This is called LW Hospitality Associates from New York City. And I just want to read their four conclusions of the executive summary. Given the historical performance of the subject market, they're talking about hotels, coupled with the anticipated supply conditions to the market and discussions with local market participants, we estimate that the subject, which is the 110-room luxury hotel on Main Street, will achieve occupancy and ADR levels of approximately 61% and a $348.59. I think that's the average daily rate, ADR, for hotel rooms. And in respectively, in the stabilized year, which is the third year. Based on operating income and expense statements of comparable property and industry averages, we anticipate the subject will achieve a net operating income of approximately $3.3 million in the stabilized year. In other words, the hotel will run at a profit with a 61% occupancy. Construction costs were not factored into this because it's not inside the scope of services, so they made estimates based on their knowledge of the industry. Those might have to change. And based on an IRR analysis contained herein, the leverage return on equity is 12.67%, and unleveraged return on total investment capital is 9.86%. So in other words, this is part of our due diligence. We have to continue to do things like this as well as the studies. The evolving design. We also wanted to make this attractive, so we get in touch with Doug Trumbull and his team about two ultra-high definition theater spaces inside the museum for an unparalleled experience. In my talks with Joe Thompson, he suggested that we have an exhibition space where we could do world-class exhibitions of architecture, maybe one or one and a half or two a year. So we added another 8,000 square feet to the end of our model, and we did a hypothetical exhibition of Japanese architecture. We've developed something like 25 exhibition projects for the EMRCA. So this is the Sirius Museum side of it. This one on Sinan Frank Gehry and Frank Lloyd Wright. They could be on trains. Here's an exhibition on the Oregon Express. This one on architecture and technology. This one on maximum cities. So I had to come back to this project. This was astounding. And starting at the end of last year, we came back to considering what the design for the museum should be. And I remember that someplace in this voluminous data that we have, that the structural design for that building that was in the Forbidden City, in the Imperial Ancestral Shrine, looked pretty much like the structural design for our building. In other words, steel is steel. And I want a warehouse space, so those dimensions aren't going to change. However, when you begin to look at the structural composition of this, and the steel structure and the steel vents, all of which came from this project, we actually built one of these. This is a project that I worked on in Shenzhen that opened in 2012 by Zhu Pei. And when I Googled it, this was in the beginning of January, it turns out the very first picture that popped up had me in it. That's me in the front row walking toward the museum. So then we started to work up the design and make it look like a railroad train. We got from Zhu Pei's office a three-dimensional model. James put the three-dimensional model into context. We started to look at it from a variety of angles and analyze whether this would have the economic impact that we were looking for. I've had a couple of preliminary talks with Steve Shepard about reviewing the economic impact analysis, because I think that if we do this building in North Adams on that site for potentially the same cost that we were anticipating for the Frank Gehry add-on, this would become a world-class destination. Absolutely no doubt about it. Everybody in the world will want to come here and see this thing. This would be amazing. And to give you some idea of the scale, we measured it against Mass MoCA. So if you want to think about this in Mass MoCA terms, when you walk in the front door of Mass MoCA, and then when you buy your ticket, and then you go through the galleries, and then you go through the former big gallery, and then you go through the new building, that's as long as our building. Here's the comparison with Mass MoCA. And here's what it would look like in plan. That's going to have, it's one room. It's an overwhelming experience. So anyway, this is what it looks like. I talked to Zhu Pei. We then started to dig down in the details, and we found that the project that was built in Shenzhen was made of stainless steel. Stainless steel is expensive. So we had a meeting with John Benziger from Skanska and Rob Malone. We looked at we dug out the information that we had on the steel skin. We understood that there was a rain screen that had a structural component underneath it. And at the end of the day, it was looking like it was going to be far too expensive to do stainless steel. However, as we were looking for alternatives, we went back to the Glasgow Transportation Museum designed by Zaha Hadid. And that's the one that has 1.3 million visitors a year. We looked at the detail of the structural design and found out that we could probably make it out of zinc at less than 1/6 of the cost that it would take to do stainless steel. So our numbers were that if we did the stainless steel option, it would cost $56 million. Our original hope was to do with a Frank Gehry component, was about $28 million. We have it in here now at $27,384. And the zinc option we could do for $28,500. In other words, we're sort of on mark on this, but it's kind of important to stay within these cost parameters, because you cannot let these projects get out of control. They could be big, but they've got to be focused. So, we're now right at the last five slides. Unfinished business, EMRCA, and the Cultural Development Master Plan. As I said, I started thinking about these things conceptually from a variety of perspectives. In the 25 years I've been fooling around with art museums, I thought that I was going to do a diagram that showed you the complexity. And when I started to do this diagram, it just broke down. I realized that there were 100 topics that I couldn't cram into this. So this is still a work on paper, which is what went into getting the EMRCA project to where it is. We continue to work on the installation. I think the design now is absolutely magnificent. And I think we're going to go forward higher than the numbers that we have on our previous economic impact analysis. If we can pull all of this together, and that's a big if, of course, then North Adams becomes the number one cultural destination in the country. If you put NatMass MoCA next to this, you keep the Holiday Inn, you have a luxury hotel, all the other activity that's taking place in the region, people flock here to Northwestern Massachusetts. It will change the economy, and it will attack what Gray Albright called those diseases of despair. So in summary, the economic impacts of Mass MoCA, we predicted 2 years ago, between 500,000 and 750 before we got this far. It would create these jobs and it would generate this economic impact. And to measure this, I was dreaming about this last night, or maybe dreading this talk. So this morning I dug out the original Mass MoCA feasibility study. And the original Mass MoCA feasibility study from 500 pages that Joe and Michael and I did was actually spot on in terms of what it does right now, what we anticipated in 1987. So all of that work that took Mass MoCA 12 years to get off the board, that we're hoping to kind of continue in 3.5, all of that work is a necessary precondition for putting a project of this scale together, and of course, the people that do it. I mean, this is hardly a complete picture because we couldn't get photographs of some of the people who've been involved in this, but this is hardly a one-person event. I mean, the number of people who have dedicated time, effort, energy, money, and talent to this project is absolutely extraordinary. And that's what will make it successful. I mean, these things are always community efforts. So that's it. I'm 5 minutes over time. I'm sorry for that. Thankfully, I'm not going to have to do this every month. I could take the year off. But it's been a pleasure. And again, I want to thank Olivier for suggesting it, because this has forced me to rethink and to put into context some of the various projects that have been developing in my head, at least for the last 3.5 decades. Thank you very much. Some people away from their Sunday dinner. If anybody wants to leave, they can leave. But I'll take a few questions.